What if they did? Just 1 year. What if everyone just stopped watching?
But they won't, Gale.
What if they did? What if we did?
Won't happen.
You root for your favorite? You cry when they get killed? It's sick.
Gale.
No one watches and they don't have a game. It's as simple as that. What?
Nothing.
Fine. Laugh at me.
I'm not laughing at you.
Down in District 12, the coal dust never really settles.
Up in the Capitol, the champagne's flowing and the dresses are on fire.
And here in the arena, we're kicking off a new season of Real Lit with Suzanne Collins' The Hunger Game and its 2020 film adaptation. Welcome to Real Lit. I'm Steven.
And I'm Mackenzie.
And we are not alone in the arena today.
We've got another volunteer-ish tribute, only the second one from our district.
Representing UNA's Department of English, please welcome Dr. Sydney Blaylock.
Hi, everyone.
Dr. Blaylock is one of our esteemed colleagues here at UNA who also specializes in a lot of film studies, as does Steven, and is currently teaching a class on video game rhetoric, correct?
Yes.
And one on martial arts last semester.
Yes.
And so Dr. Blaylock graduated from NTSU with his PhD in English, specifically focusing on rhetoric, composition, and film. He's also published over a dozen science fiction stories, and his first publication was a comic story, which is really, really cool. He also has a conference publication over the Hunger Games while teaching science fiction film courses, so he is uber qualified to be with us today specifically.
And I'll just start a quick... Not to steal your thunder, throw out a quick caveat, I am underqualified. I had never read any of the books, never seen the film, and I still have only seen the film twice and read the book one time. Although Mackenzie's going to make sure that I am a complete Pan Am expert at this point.
You right? have to read all of them.
Yeah. So sorry I did not get to all those listeners, but I am only going to be speaking on the first one. I don't know about y'all. Y'all can go crazy on whichever.
And so going off that point that I love The Hunger Games, I'll just go ahead and give you that warning. So sorry if I get a little excited and shouty, Steven. I know those headphones are sensitive.
Very.
So I'll proceed with caution. But there are minor differences in the book and film that we need to address first. I actually really appreciate how well this series, the filmmakers, followed the books. But there are little differences. Mostly in point of view, right? The book is entirely in first person, present tense, from Katniss's perspective. Every scene is filtered through her survival instincts, guilt, and classic cynicism that I love about Katniss. The film, by necessity, pulls this back into third person omniscience. We get cutaway scenes where Katniss is not present, but it is just not possible to have that first person narration in a film.
Yeah, and I did that backwards. I usually like to read the book first and then watch a film if I can. And, of course, we had it for movie night. It was at May, I believe we did, for our English Club movie night. And I saw the film for the first time. I started Tuesday reading this book. But it's a quick read. I love the book. It's amazing. That first-person perspective, you know, I went back and rewatched it yesterday. And Jennifer Lawrence, I just got to shout her out. Her facial acting is incredible. And I don't want to step on my close read. But, you know, knowing what she's thinking from reading the book. And then seeing Jennifer Lawrence make those facial expressions, it's amazing. I was so impressed with that. You know, we talk a lot about facial acting on here, right? Mm-hmm. But we got our Mount Rushmore of facial actors. Lumi Cavazos, Rowena King.
So good.
So good. Michelle Pfeiffer. And if you don't know what we're referring to, you can scroll on down and listen to our other episodes. Sorry, shameless plug.
Oh, look at you. Sneaking in cross-promo mid-episode. But you're absolutely right. Lawrence's face is doing the work here. That scene in the cave with Peeta, you know, on the page, it's all Katniss second-guessing herself. But on screen, you just get that flicker in her eyes. You know, just a little bit of calculation of, do I actually feel this? Or is it for the cameras? And so I think she portrays that emotion very well.
Yeah, personally. She does. The film plays it completely genuine romance, whereas the book gives a nuance. Both mine and Mackenzie's favorite word, nuance. It's complex. You know, is she really falling for him? Is she swept up in a manufactured narrative the cameras create? I love that about the book. It felt like a commentary on the nature of reality TV that is so ubiquitous nowadays. We all know there's nothing more unreal, but I'm going to hold off on that because my close read delves into that a good bit.
That's fair. And because of this perspective, the games are Katniss's reality in the book, right? In the film, we're also part of the audience watching as well, seeing the production behind it.
Also, it is a violent book. Like, I did not realize that. I did not expect, like, Iliad-level violence when I picked this thing up. I knew it was, you know, they're killing each other. I knew it had to be some blood. But they really did dial that back in the film to get that coveted PG-13 rating.
Right, for a young adult film.
Yeah, some of those descriptions, I'm like, dude. Or, like, what's the guy's name, the big bad?
Cato.
Yeah, Cato. Like, when he's getting eaten by the mutts, and it just keeps going. I noticed that, like, in the film, she does have Mercy shoot him, but it's only, like, a few seconds. Whereas, what, it takes, like, all night? He's still chewing on that poor guy? Well, not poor guy. He kind of deserves it, but...
I empathize with Cato.
He's one of my least favorite characters, but we will get there eventually.
Most hated character. You know that's coming up. Mackenzie's not going to let that one go.
I love it. Do you agree? Do you like the film adaptations of the books?
I do. I think they are very accurate to the book. So much so that I think that they are a great representation of what an adaptation in the modern sense truly is. I think that some audience members might have wanted a little bit more of Katniss inside of the movie, but I think what we got was a very strong adaptation, if not at the same level of Harry Potter, very close and in some ways superior.
I agree, because there's so much in the Harry Potter books that doesn't even make it close to the screen, right? I think The Hunger Games, as you said, was a faithful adaptation. I think they did the best they could.
There's a lot of world building. I noticed that you know, you immerse yourself in this Panem culture and the capital, like, what a weird place. Just, like, fashion sense, people, what happened to it?
I love it. I love how dramatic it is.
I don't know. We're going to talk about it. Wes Bentley's beard. That is a crime against humanity.
Oh, but the imagery. And so we're going to focus on the book and film as well, with my close read being for the book. And I'm focusing through the lens of ethical literary criticism here. I felt like it was a clear choice to talk about ethics. We could deep dive on each character, but I want to talk more about the novel illustrating that even in desperate circumstances, ethical choices define who we are, reminding readers that integrity matters most when it's the hardest to maintain. Because I think that we get the survival theme, but sometimes we forget to question the ethics of it. And to me, PETA and Katniss are ethical foils. And hear me out, because I'm not saying either is antagonistic. But they are representative of the ethical struggle Panem has forced on each citizen, not just those in the arena. We see it most clearly and physically in the arena, but it's actually happening all year round to everyone within the society. So in survival stories, the central question is rarely whether a character can live, but rather what kind of person they must become in order to survive. The Hunger Games throws its characters into a violent spectacle designed to strip them of their humanity, forcing them to choose between moral integrity and physical endurance. Through the lens of ethical literary criticism, the novel reveals that desperate circumstances do not erase ethics, but instead create higher stakes for moral decision-making in that process. Katniss and PETA function as ethical foils, with Katniss embodying this pragmatic survival ethic, while PETA represents this ethical integrity. Neither is an antagonist to the other, but together they emphasize the ethical struggle that Panem imposes on all of its citizens, the tension between surviving at any cost and resisting in a way that preserves one humanity, and almost preventing the two from coexisting. Katniss enters the games carrying the responsibility of survival long before she steps into the arena. Right from the opening chapters, her willingness to provide for her family through hunting and even illegal trade establishes her moral code, as she will do whatever is necessary to keep herself and her loved ones alive. Her decision to volunteer for Prim is framed not only as an act of love, but also as a pragmatic choice. It maximized her sister's survival. In this sense, Katniss operates within a utilitarian ethic, which I would love to go down the rabbit hole of.
Jeremy Bentham.
But this means that she's weighing outcomes and prioritizing strategies that give the greatest chance of endurance. However, it is how these ideals extend beyond her family that creates this ethical conflict. Katniss quickly identifies alliances and threats in training and in the arena, measuring every relationship in terms of survival. Even her decision to ally with Rue could be seen as a pragmatic but emotional decision, because Rue has knowledge about healing and can provide Katniss with emotional support. So it comes across as strictly emotional, especially when we're seeing it in the film, but it does have pragmatic qualities. Then when Rue is killed, pause for everyone to take a moment.
Oh gosh.
Yet when Rue is killed, Katniss's decision to honor her body with flowers interrupts her survival-driven logic that we've seen with every other character, most likely due to the parallelism with her sister. That deliberate act of compassion signals these cracks in her utilitarian framework. She knows the Capitol cameras are watching, and yet she chooses to risk her safety to assert a moral claim that Rue's death will not be reduced to a meaningless spectacle. Moments like this define character more than victories or defeats, more than her winning the Hunger Games. For Katniss, survival is essential, but her story shows the cost of relying too heavily on pragmatic choices in a world that punishes any personal morality. In contrast, PETA's approach to the games highlights an ethic concerned on integrity rather than sheer survival. From the moment he confesses his love for Katniss during the interviews, PETA demonstrates that he values authenticity even in the face of death. They both come out winners, but with entirely different strategies. His insistence on remaining true to himself, like when he states, "I want to die as myself," marks his guiding moral framework. Where Katniss calculates outcomes, PETA resists calculation altogether. For him, the ultimate defeat would not be death, but the loss of his identity under the Capitol's control. He takes much less interest in sizing up his opponents and spends more time in self-reflection that we don't even get in that inner monologue. But you have to assume that he's thinking something. He's going through something. And it's like he's reflecting on his own personal ideals instead of focusing on everyone else. PETA's actions throughout the games reinforce this ethic. He never once entertains the idea of killing Katniss, even though doing so might improve his odds of survival. Instead, his choices consistently prioritize moral integrity over strategic advantage. In doing so, PETA embodies a different kind of resistance to the Capitol, a quiet but unyielding refusal to become what the games demand. This is not naive idealism, but a deliberate moral stance that frames an assertion of humanity within a very oppressive system. His ethic does not guarantee survival, but it guarantees that, no matter the outcome, his choices will reflect the kind of person he chooses to be. PETA, with his integrity ethic, represents the moral resistance necessary to prevent complicity. These frameworks are not wholly opposed, but exist in constant tension of each other, shaping how the characters evolve. The tension between their ethical codes produces not just survival, but resistance. Through Katniss and PETA as ethical foils, the novel illustrates the dual pressures of survival and integrity, emphasizing the central question Panem imposes on its citizens. Not just how to survive, but how to remain human while doing so. In the end, the novel suggests that integrity and survival are not mutually exclusive, but must work in tension if true freedom is ever possible. Like how Katniss suggests eating the Nightlock berries together out of strategic chance, but PETA agrees by moral code and trust. Together, it paved the path to their freedom and success. And that's my close read.
I think that is a great reading of the work, Mackenzie. I think that one of the key and central tenets that Katniss comes to understand, especially after Rue's death, is the idea of what it means to be an ethical person in an unethical situation. Mm-hmm. And that ethics isn't about an outside formulation, but rather who you are inside. And that's one of the things that I really enjoyed about the book, even though I hated Rue's death, is that Rue's death is a catalyst for the humanity that already resides inside of Katniss to be shown and illustrated through her love of another person, even if it isn't her love of Prim. Even a competitor can be someone that she empathizes with and ultimately wants to see the best for.
Absolutely. And I think we just too often generally read PETA and Katniss as very surface level characters, and they're not.
Yes.
I don't think. And so that was kind of in my close read. I wanted to look at their ethical depth rather than their just standard survival archetype. you know.
Y'all quit talking about Rue. I mean, I was openly weeping in public when we watched it in the movie club. That broke my heart.
I told him he needs to watch the rest. It only gets worse.
From there, yes.
Maybe I don't need to. So for my close read, I want to pull in a little Foucault, specifically Discipline and Punish. Don't roll your eyes, Mackenzie or Sydney, or honestly half of our audience. Now, when we did screen The Hunger Games as part of the English department's movie club, we've got to come up with a snazzier name than that, don't we? But it was May, right? It was the first time I'd ever seen it, and of course there are students there. Then, you know, every time we finish the film, me, Sydney, Brenna, Mackenzie get up, and we have a little discussion. The students talk, they ask questions. And I was so excited, you know, because, like I said, I'd never seen this film. I was like, oh my God, this is straight out of Foucault's Discipline and Punish. And as I said that, I saw one of our students, Mordecai, I saw their eyes just glaze over. Like, oh no, not theory. But Foucault says in that book that society's used to control through spectacle. Public executions, torture, the sovereign literally inscribing power into the body. But in modern times, control shifts to discipline and surveillance. Instead of chopping off heads in the square, you build prisons, schools, hospitals, barracks. The goal isn't to kill the body, it's to normalize it, to train it into what Foucault calls docile bodies. His big metaphor for this is the panopticon, speaking of utilitarianism, Mackenzie. Mm-hmm. Jeremy Bentham's prison designed where one guard sits in a central tower and all the prisoners are arranged around him. The genius, or probably the horror, of the panopticon is that you never know if you're being watched. So you behave as if you're always being watched. Surveillance gets internalized. And by the way, if panopticon sounds too abstract, James Gunn actually gives us a literal one in the first Guardians of the Galaxy. The Kiln prison is basically a sci-fi panopticon. Guards in the tower, inmates in the cells, and everyone acting like they're constantly under the gaze. Same logic, just with more prosthetics and mixtapes. And even further back, Orwell had his telescreens in 1984. The idea that you're never off camera, never unobserved. We call them smart TVs now, and it's not Big Brother, but Big Bezos listening in. Same principle, just with faster shipping.
Yes.
Now take that to the Hunger Games. The games are the capital's big spectacle. Punishment as theater, to use the Foucauldian term. Forcing kids to kill each other isn't just entertainment. It's the state demonstrating its absolute control. It terrifies the district into obedience. But at the same time, the arena is a panopticon. The tributes never know where their cameras are, so they perform as if they're always being watched. Katniss literally moderates her behavior, her facial expressions, even her romance with Peeta, because she knows the capital audience is watching. The cave scene is a perfect example. Peeta's bleeding out, Katniss kisses him, and as viewers we know two things are happening at once. Yes, she cares, but she's also making sure the capital sees her caring. It's affection as survival strategy. And the kicker, the capital audience isn't passive. By swooning over the star-crossed lovers, they're helping reproduce the capital's power. The whole thing is performance stacked upon performance. Almost like I chose that quote at the beginning for a reason, huh? So it's literal panopticon. Orwell's telescreens or Bezos hiding in your smart TV. The point is the same. When you know you might be watched, you change your behavior. And that's what we call the Hawthorne effect. That comes into play. That's a fancy name for when people alter what they're doing simply because they're aware they're being observed. And I think the cave scene is the purest distillation of that. Katniss isn't just tending to Peeta's wounds out of affection, but she's calibrating every touch, every kiss for the capital cameras, knowing every flicker of emotion is being broadcast. They send that, you know, canister of soup down with a parachute, and she opens it up, and it, what does it say? You call that a kiss? So it's kind of pushing that again. Anyway, in the book, it makes crystal clear that her interior monologues, that she's literally just thinking about how this is going to play out to the audience. The film can't give us her thoughts, but as I said before, Jennifer Lawrence does all the heavy lifting with her face. There's that flicker of calculation right before the kiss. That's not just love, it's survival strategy under the Hawthorne effect. So whether you call it spectacle, the panopticon, or the Hawthorne effect, The Hunger Games isn't just a story about kids fighting to the death. It's about how power performs itself and how people learn to perform under power. And that might be the scariest part. Performance never really ends. Also, just so you know, it is literally in academic bylaws that if you're discussing The Hunger Games, you have to say panopticon at least 7 times. If you can't, I think they can revoke your tenure. But either way, I think I'm safe now.
Yeah, take the note.
And for my close read, I want to talk about rhetoric. And when do I not talk about rhetoric?
That's okay.
But for this one, I actually want to talk about rhetorical criticism. and the way in which we can break something apart using rhetoric to get at a deeper meaning that's behind what's being discussed. And for The Hunger Games, there are two pieces of rhetorical criticism that I want to touch on, each briefly in this segment. The first one I want to touch on is one that is brought to us by Elise Keller and Katie Gibson, and they discuss the appropriation of the male gaze in The Hunger Games and the way that Katniss reifies the male gaze so that it turns from something that is dehumanizing into something that makes Katniss a very strong and very powerful central character who just happens to be female. One of the things that I really like about their conception of the female hero and the male gaze is that they actually do a breakdown of the male gaze in terms of 1980s action movies, such as Aliens and Terminator 2, which both feature very prominent female characters. However, they theorize that those characters are popular with males because they embody many of the male traits. They're decisive, they're strong, and they push forward. And love is not a major component of their characterization. However, they see Katniss as someone who pushes against that male gaze, who's not there because she's strong. She's there because she is a hunter. She's there because she is powerful and a survivor, and that she only wants to survive. And many of the things that she does, males would do in that similar situation. So that's a breakdown of her internal characteristics. And it really shows that as a heroine, she's not a female heroine who is demure and who is wanting someone to look at them, but rather she is someone who is wanting to survive for Prim, for her mother, for Gale, for Peeta, for Rue, and ultimately for herself. And I really love the way that they devote part of their article to the idea of pushing back against the male gaze and making females into real human characters who have real motivations and who, when confronted with the male gaze of the camera, they actually are curious as to how the camera is going to pick up their actions, but they're also a bit disgusted by the actions of the viewers and the audience, and they aren't afraid to let that disgust show. Whereas characters like Ripley, characters like Sarah Connor, they are vehicles through which males and their desires can be imprinted upon. Another thing that I really like about rhetorical criticism is that we can talk about a little bit more controversial things. And that's what happens with S.R. Tolliver's Alterity and Innocence, The Hunger Games, Rue, and Black Girl Adultification. And in this particular rhetorical criticism, the author discusses the ways in which Rue counterbalances traditional African-American female perspectives in film and in the book. And I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but there was a major controversy about Rue and Rue's casting when The Hunger Games was released. There was a social media outcry against Rue, and some of the screen grabs that were taken at the time were, KK, call me racist, but when I found out Rue was black, her death wasn't as sad. Hashtag, I hate myself.
Oh my God.
Or, why does Rue have to be black? Not gonna lie, kinda ruined the movie. And there were others during this particular time frame. Now, the author illustrates why this happens in terms of African-American females being portrayed as not girls, but as women who, once they're women, then they can be victimized and they can be dehumanized in many aspects of media. And what this particular author does is she does a framework that looks at all the ways in which, in the book, Ruhr is portrayed against the negative stereotype of Black women as lascivious, asexual, angry, and servile. And Rue completely turns that dynamic on its head. She's considered to be small yellow flower, a 12-year-old girl, a magical wisp of a tribute, a wispy child, and that with Katniss, there's often the terms of we, us, our. And she continues that all throughout the book and shows how Suzanne Collins uses language to bring Rue down from the adultification that has happened to many other Black women in the media representations, and how Rue actually plays against that type and plays to show that we can work together as a society even in the most difficult and trying circumstances. So again, while controversial, rhetorical criticism really allows you to get at the heart of what's in that piece of media by breaking it apart into individual aspects. And that's one of the reasons why I love rhetoric so much.
That is so interesting. I have not read those comments.
Disgusting.
Yes, they were very prevalent at the time. Many have been pulled from the social media platforms that they were posted, but you can find news articles as well as you can find them through the Wayback Machine and other tools that keep parts of the internet alive.
Yeah, that's awful. Her death crushed me.
Yeah. Oh, again, I wept publicly. And I had to know she was going to die because, you know, Hunger Games, but gosh.
But still.
On a lighter note, there's got to be a drinking game for real lit, right? Every time we say male gaze, take a shot.
Male gaze. Yes.
I knew we were not going to get through another episode without it.
Even what you were discussing with PETA and, well, you were discussing Katniss, and it made me think, I would defend PETA as a damsel in distress archetype.
Yes, I would agree.
I would say that he also has flipped in that kind of role.
Yes. He does have some masculinity because if we go to the movie, we do show the strength and that he's being looked at like prey. But you're right. It is Katniss that saves him. It is Katniss who is the driver. Even through the love that is shown, we're not sure that it is true love or if it is love that is manufactured for the benefit of the capital.
Right. Right. And speaking of our camera angles...
What do you mean, speaking of camera angles?
I was going to say we're going to go to our advertiser.
Oh, what's that to do with camera angles?
I just constantly picture it as a commercial.
Oh,
I just constantly picture it as like an infomercial that pops up on my screen.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, before we step back into the arena, let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsor. This episode is Senna's Costuming.
Tired of looking like just another face in District 12 coal dust? Want to stand out at your next public execution, parade, or reaping?
At Senna's, we believe fashion should be more than fabric. It should be fire, literally. Whether it's a tasteful smolder or a full-on inferno, we'll make sure you're the spark that everyone remembers.
And don't worry, our designs aren't just about turning heads. They're also capital approved, which means no flammable mishaps. Unless, of course, you want a flammable mishap.
From subtle political statements to full-scale rebellions, Senna's got you covered. Cloaks, gowns, battle gear, we tailor for every occasion.
Senna's Costuming, because in Panem, it's not enough to survive. You've got to look stunning doing it.
May the odds be ever in your fashion.
Crushed it!
I have so much fun writing these. Every time I do it, I'm like...
Steven is so good at them.
Very amazing.
That was so much fun.
So
I love those.
Yes.
And I love that we leave our advertisements straight to Most Hated Character. It's like the hill in the middle of the script. Because on Most Hated Character...
You'll die on those hills.
I'll die on those hills. I will die on those hills. And I cannot say that I hate President Snow. I cannot say it. I understand he is the main antagonist, and perhaps I have some discrepancies here, because I have read and watched The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, and that is the tale of President Snow by Collins, but I simply don't hate him. I think he is far too necessary. It's honestly hard to hate anyone in this book, but I also adore this series, so again, there's some love coming into play that is stomping my hate. I suppose it would need to be Seneca Crane, because he is just so, like, ugh the entire time. It's one thing to be a villain, but he's not even a good one, you know? He's not very cunning, he's not sly, he has a very pristine look that is memorable, but he's just so indecisive. Although he does display a crucial role in setting up one of my absolute favorite scenes in the next film, so I have to thank him for that, but he's just flat. For me, he's like a filler, I think.
Yeah, it's Seneca Crane, which is surprising because I thought it would be impossible for me to hate someone named Seneca. I mean, he is probably my favorite Roman playwright.
Sure.
I think he's a doo-doo human being, but it's the beard. Like, what in the facial topiary is that thing?
I love the beard!
And also, I just have to say, the actor, Wes Bentley, he has such a punchable face.
Oh.
And I say this with no shade towards Bentley, not at all. A little bit of shade, because he ruined one of my favorite villains in Blackheart in that awful Nick Cage Ghost Rider film. But I think it was more just a crappy script for that one. I just mean that he has a face that's made to play a villain, and he does it really well. I'm actually praising him here. He's good at it when he's not crying over the beauty of a plastic bag flitting in the wind.
And for me, I have a first runner-up, and I believe it is the young man who actually kills Rue, who I believe is from District 1. But my true villain that I absolutely must hate is Cato. Mm. In the book, his ending is pathetic, and it is something that gives me a little bit of sympathy for him. However, in the film, he is played as a villain, and he is very much the character who you're supposed to hate. But also, his actor does such a wonderful job of making you want to hate him that I just cannot. I just cannot. He does earn a bit of it back when he does reference the unfairness of it all at the end. But still, I just don't like Cato.
Yeah. And
Marvel,
I understand.
By the way. I'm sorry.
Marvel?
Marvel is the one that kills Rue.
Marvel, okay.
And, fun fact, played by Jack Quaid. You know who his parents are?
Dennis Quaid.
And Meg Ryan. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That's him. He was also in Novocaine, which is an awful film, and Companion, I just saw. That was pretty decent. I like that one.
That is interesting.
Very cool.
Interesting. When we go into our academic style, I already knew some of the things I was going to say. I'm excited. For Enjoy, yes, 1,000,000,000%. All gold stars, and I realize this is a young adult, faster read, but I honestly don't think we give it enough credit for the depth and undertones past that narrative dialogue that I think, you know, because a young audience is so interested and invested in this series, sometimes we overlook it in the academic world. But I love this book and film. I love them all. But I've watched this first one about a dozen times. In the background, intently, just whenever. It's like my go-to that can just be playing and I'd be content with.
Kind of like Wonder Boys for me. Yeah, I really did enjoy them both, even though I did go out of order. I usually like to do the book, then the film. Still, I don't think that was the worst thing to do, because like I said, it really did give me a new appreciation for Jennifer Lawrence's acting when I rewatched it. Generally, I avoid the YA genre, and there's no shade to that either. It's just, I'm a 47-year-old curmudgeon. Yeah, I'm not the target audience. But I'm often reminded there's some real gems in that genre. And I know, again, you're going to force me to hang into this, this entire franchise until I've read and watched them all. You commit for me.
You have volunteered as tribute.
You volunteered me as a tribute. This is not a reaping. Stop.
I'm going to be controversial here and say, when I first read this, I did not like it. I read it for a young adult course that I was taking for my graduate studies. And I thought it was, don't hate me, chick lit. However, I was able to hear a podcast, a documentary, I'm not sure what it was, on Jennifer Lawrence. And it talked about her previous work to this film, and it talked about how it made her a perfect candidate for Katniss. And so I was intrigued. I read it again, thanks to my lovely science fiction class students, thank you, at MTSU. And I loved the book, and then I wanted to watch the movie, and I was floored. And ever since then, I have loved it. So I have come around.
I love it.
Was it Winter's Bone? Is that the one she did?
Yes, I believe that is the correct
one. The one with her, was her parents are a meth, or dad's a meth addict.
Yes, that's
yeah, she is correct. Very much a Katniss figure somewhat in that one. I never thought about that.
Yes.
She's also, Jennifer Lawrence is in this very obscure horror film called, like, The House at the End of the Street.
Not obscure.
Is it not? Because I couldn't find it on anything.
I know it. I've seen
until,
it.
Well, it's pretty good, too.
Yeah, I agree. I like that one.
And I like her. I think she's great.
And then she did Red Sparrow. That was awful.
Aww.
She does, like, I don't like romantic comedies, but that one on Netflix, I forget what it's called, but, like, this kid's, like, a dork, and his parents pay her to date him. It's a truly funny film.
Okay.
I can't think of the name now, but it's worth watching.
I'll watch whatever Jennifer Lawrence is in.
I like J-Lo.
I trust her.
Me too.
I trust her. And then for teaching, absolutely, and I did. I personally believe this book is suitable for all readers over 13. I mean, the tributes are 12 to 18, so I think there's a really good demographic relatability there. I think there are endless possibilities for different angles here. So I taught this to 9th graders, and it was super fun to discuss. We broke into districts in the classroom and critically think about real issues that they had faced or were going to face in their high school careers. But I will say, the day that I both loved the most and created the most fear in me is when I held our very own Hunger Games on the practice field. I thought this was a great idea. And it was. We had the best time.
Please tell me it was Nerf weapons.
No. Okay, so it was kind of like Capture the Flag, and the career tributes were guarding the flag with pool noodles. And you had these marshmallows that you pelted at each other. So it made you go back to the start line. It was a whole thing. I have the rule sheet. We should have a department Hunger Game. It'd be a great time. But for the class that was made up of 16 boys, it was an experience. But we had a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun. I would do it again. But it was extremely successful. The kids were really interested in it. It's something that they were familiar with, something that they could relate to. So I would teach it again. Maybe more at a high school level. Honestly, I'd say a high school or like a graduate level, honestly, because a graduate level could get into criticisms and get a little bit deeper into it. So in that middle area, maybe not.
That's what I'm thinking. It's film scholar catnip, right?
Yeah.
Katniss. But there have been so much commentary about the gays, meta-commentary. I'm not going to get into all that because I've got some shelf criticism episodes, actually. I want to talk about that with films like Vacancy or... I love any time you're watching someone watch something else in a film because I always think that's meta-commentary. I could probably write a whole dissertation on that, but I'm not going to. I'm busy.
I also have taught this. Unfortunately, I taught it during the time of COVID, so I don't think it was as effective as it could have been. And I taught it to undergraduates, and we spent a week to 2 weeks on it, and I thought it was very effective. We did talk a little bit about the controversies, Rue, femininity, and the focus on women, and I paired it with women's issues and women's studies, and I allowed the women to talk about some of their own experiences where they were fearful, and it opened my eyes to many of the problems, the trials, and the tribulations that women have to go through on a daily basis. And I think it was eye-opening to some of the male students in the course as well. Again, it was online and it was via Zoom, so I don't think it had the effect that it could have had, but I do think that it was at least an effective start for some of the people in class to really start thinking about these important issues.
I love that. When we go into scholarship, I mean, Dr. Blaylock brought up two fantastic articles that I now want to read. So there's absolutely space for this. I personally think this is one of the 21st century works that will be canonized. I really do.
If the canon still exists.
We'll keep the canon. We'll keep the canon. It just created a fandom, first of all, which I think is one of the ways we have to score literary pieces now. Had multiple successful books and brought real world challenges and problems to the forefront of young adults' minds, which isn't easy to do. You know, especially with so many different media streams and everyone's into something different now. This is one of the few cultural ties that this generation still has to each other. It's become a cultural icon. And we also have ideas here of media manipulation, which has taken over all present conversations, right, with AI use. So there's even room now to analyze this through a newer lens, thinking about how the media is manipulated throughout the Hunger Games and how we're seeing effects that are similar now.
Yeah, for me, I'm going to go on like a bit of a digression, but I was searching, as I always do. I go to the databases and just see what's out there. And I kept getting stuff about like classifying EKG signals and detecting spam and sending it to folders. And I'm like, what is going on here? And it turns out there's an algorithm that is named after this franchise. So I asked ChatGPT to describe what that algorithm was, and this is what I got. The Hunger Games search algorithm, speaking of AI.
Yeah.
The Hunger Games search algorithm, HGSA, is actually a meta-heuristic optimization algorithm. It was proposed in 2019 by Mohamed Youssef and colleagues. The name comes from the idea of modeling the competition and survival dynamics from the Hunger Games. Individuals, candidate solutions, compete, in quotes, for resources, and the strongest survive and improve over generations. I think I understood maybe every third word of that.
Just a lot of fancy words.
Some trivia for you.
And for me, I just want to reemphasize the two articles that I referenced, S.R. Tolliver, Alterity and Innocence, The Hunger Games, Rue and Black Girl Identification, published in the Journal of Children's Literature, and Appropriating the Male Gaze in The Hunger Games, The Rhetoric of a Resistant Female Vantage Point by Elise Keller and Katie L. Gibson, published in the Texas Speech and Communications Journal. But I do also want to note that I do think the ideas of The Hunger Games will be around for quite a while. There was an article that I did not think to bring that discusses the ways in which the three-fingered salute has already appeared in the world, specifically with Asian protests in the Asian region in the mid-2010s and late 2010s, just before the pandemic. That was a very important symbol that was used to signify struggle against oppressive governments in that region. So I think that we're going to be seeing a lot of concepts and ideas brought forward into real life and culture based on what's inside the book and what images are shown from the movie.
Very interesting.
It's almost like culture, like books and movies, influence the very time it's created in the same way that the history influences the culture.
Wow, it's like we teach.
That's new historicism. WTF moment. Besides Wes Bentley's beard, this is less WTF and more like jump scare. But when the girl from Orphan throws the knife at Katniss and she's in the cornucopia retrieving PETA's medicine, what was Clove? Is that her name? I knew something was going to happen, but it still startled me. So well done.
Yeah, that's fair. And there are a few moments like that that are just almost kind of like jump scares, like when Haymitch uses his foot on Katniss in the car. I was like, okay. But I'm thinking back to the first time I read this book and watched this film, and it's when Effie walks out on the stage. She's dressed so outrageously, right? But then she's extremely cheerful. So the juxtaposition here with the scene is just so comical but sad. I remember thinking, what the heck is this lady so happy about? Why would she even think to speak this way to these people? And I understand that it's a performance, right? But it's just to watch it, you're like, man, this is, why would you do this? Also, when Katniss gets so angry about PETA's crush declaration, like, come on. Do you really have to be jerky about that? Is it really something to get so mad about? I don't know. Just those moments where I don't understand what they're doing.
You know, I do have to say, I forgot to say this in the early segment, but one of the differences in the book and the film is, like, Effie is just, she exists in the book. But it's, again, let's sing some actress praises. Elizabeth Banks, man, she takes that role and she makes it hers.
And it's fantastic. I love to watch Effie across the films. I really, really do.
Same here. Effie is one of my standout characters.
Yeah. Elizabeth Banks also directed one of my favorite movies of all time, Cocaine Bear.
Oh, my goodness.
And for me, I think my WTF moment would be when I read the book, or rather reread the book, and I actually understood what Katniss was giving up when she volunteered. She was giving up her life, or at that moment, what she thought was her future life, for her sister. And that just really hit me hard. I guess it would for anybody who, for whom family is important, and family for me is important, and to have someone step up in that manner is just mind-blowing to me.
Yeah. I think it's important to consider also the age differences when we have that conversation, because, you know, Katniss is almost out of this.
Yes.
She's almost done with reaping, and her sister has just begun.
Yes, and also not just begun, but only has her name in once. So what are the odds?
In their favor.
Not in their favor.
Right, and then for our geek out segment, so I just have to give little 12-year-old me, you know, its moment. Because when I was 12 and I was Team PETA, you know, when PETA and Katniss finally kiss, I hadn't read the book yet. I was just like, oh, yay, I hope they get together. But I must go with the film in my regular geek out. The play with light and sound and lack of sound, really, is just immaculate throughout the entirety. I have several scenes in mind, like the serenity of the forest before the abrupt humming of the hovercraft, and we have that technology versus nature, the silent ear-ringing tone as the initial countdown begins for Katniss, but for a somewhat unconventional geek out, it's the scene where Katniss's scream is silent and Rue is left in the flowers. I love the scene. I love the imagery. The silence, I think, is incredibly effective. The contrast of color, like it's a halo around Rue's body. This also sets up the part of film number two that is, like, my favorite scene. I reference Seneca Crane and Rue.
Yeah, stop talking about Rue. I'm not going to cry again. And by the way, I missed a lot of that the first time I watched it because I was just bawling. I was bawling, and I'm like, students around, Mordecai right beside me, and I'm like, I can't do it. Thankfully, they didn't make fun of me. But for me, it's the beginning of the games. You know, Haymitch tells them not to go for the cornucopia with good reason. But man, that scene, it's like so well shot. Mm-hmm. And there's that haunting stretch of brutal violence that happens. So there's the camera work, the frantic pace. There's the, this cast is so bloated, let's wipe about half the playing field off immediately vibes. I mean, but it worked well. And really, because up until that point, you know, we've been training, we've been at the Capitol, and the tone is all whimsical and colorful, and Effie, just bonkers Effie. There are jokes, like when Katniss shoots the apple out of the pig's mouth.
So good.
And then the games begin, and you remember, you know, the proverbial poo hits the proverbial fan, and you're like, oh yeah, this is violence. This is real stakes here.
Yeah.
So I think that really set the tone for that next part of the movie that really just stuck with me.
And I really enjoyed the scene where we see Katniss getting the 11 and all that comes from that. I really love the way in which we see the effect that the score has on Katniss and, unfortunately, even on PETA and everyone else. But getting that acknowledgement, again, from shooting of the apple, that defiance, that one element marks something that is going to be sparked at the end of this film and then carries on further into the other films. And I think, have to be careful because Stephen hasn't seen the rest of them.
I don't mind spoilers.
I think that the spark that ignites what comes next is from that 11. There are other places, but I think she is the catalyst and she is the girl on fire once she gets that 11.
Yes. I love that point of it starting right then, because it's not the winning of the Hunger Games. You know, it's not a super dramatic, action-packed moment.
Yes.
And that's why when, Stephen, when you were talking about the entirety of the film in a half and a half, people don't realize when you're watching it, the first 50% and maybe even 60% are not in the games. Mm-hmm. In all the films, like, really the first half is not the action-packed. And they keep you invested. And I think that's a testament to their film as well.
Definitely.
I agree. You actually got me wanting to watch them now.
Good.
Yes. Mission accomplished.
Yes.
Oh, final thoughts. Panopticon. Just in case I didn't get all my seven in.
Oh, we'll count. We'll do a recount. And just please, everyone read the rest of these books. I loved The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. That's about President Snow. And I also really liked Sunrise on the Reaping. It was Hamish Abernathy's story. So really cool character to get a story on. It's not the most academic, thought-provoking series in the world initially, but it is very enjoyable from beginning to end. And very rarely do I love everything that happens in the middle. And I do in these books. There's not one book that I disliked. I liked all of them from beginning to end. So
I have to wholeheartedly agree. It was my undergraduate students who actually got me to read books 3 and 4. And they kept talking about one particular character that does not appear in book 1, but does appear in books 2 and 3. Fennec is the character that everyone talked about. His name was on everyone's lips. And when I let my students know that I hadn't yet read books 2 and 3, they stopped talking. They said, "We're not going to give you any spoilers, Mr. Bullock," because I didn't have my PhD at that time. And they said, "You must read these other two books, and you must tell us what you think about Fennec." So please, if you've not read books 2 and 3, that's your homework going forward.
I know what I'm doing this weekend.
I love it.
Any others? Free for all here.
Unless we go down a big old rabbit hole, which I'm happy to go down any rabbit hole.
If you feel froggy, jump on it.
You know what's interesting about this first book and film is that we don't get much of our main antagonist, President Snow.
Very true. Yes.
And that is super interesting for a first book because everyone's an antagonist in this particular plot. And I think that's why it works, because President Snow grows over the course of the next books. But I look back on that now and I'm like, it's crazy that our main villain was not a main part.
On the books. Yes, it's very much that he is ancillary and that all of the other characters many of the other characters form the antagonist. And we always have the ever-present of Cato and the careers as being one of the major antagonists. But yes, I was rewatching the movie for this podcast, and you see only hints of President Snow's potential menace, but he is ever present in the background by being president, by being the one who rules over the Capitol and has the power. So I agree wholeheartedly. This isn't a traditional protagonist-antagonist book in the traditional sense, but his shadow looms large over everything.
And everything about him, everyone's thinking about him the whole time.
Yes.
And that's what I like, that you use the word ever-present. He's just over everything because everyone's thinking about him. And when he uses the berries, the Nightlock berries, that made me kind of like him. I like the dramatic, the dramatic death of it all, the poetics.
Does he actually, you're talking about when they lock him in the room, like for punishment.
Yes.
He doesn't strike me as like the seppuku kind of guy who's going to take his life because he failed. Does he actually, like you read
Seneca?
The other books.
I mean, he had to.
Had to. No choice.
He had to eat the berries or just sit in there, I guess.
Yes, he was either going to starve. They locked him in and he was either going to starve or he was going to eat the berries. One of the two.
Okay, that makes more sense. Yes. I know he's not going to do the noble thing, the presumed noble thing and do that.
Yes.
All right, here's one I want to ask you. Caesar Floppenheimer.
Blickerman.
Yes.
I like Floppenheimer better, though. Either way, why do I like him so much?
I love him.
I think part of it is Stanley Tucci. It's hard not to like Stanley Tucci. Yes. Remember when he played Puck in Midsummer Night's Dream? That was great. But I should not like this character. I just do.
Yeah.
Well, I think because he takes one specific element from the book and he hinges that performance on that element. Yes, he's loud. Yes, he's brash. Yes, he's all that. But in the book, there's a line that says that he's always trying to help the tribute. Anything that he does is trying to help the tribute. So even though he's this foppish character, ultimately, he's trying to help the tribute be better and win those sponsors. Even though it's a very messed up way of doing it, he's always has the tribute's best interest in mind. Or at least that's the way it seems to me.
Yes, I can see that. Well, I know you two could talk about it for the entire rest of the night, right? But
I mean, we could get into book two and...
and just go. Yes.
Let me read it first, yes. Since you've already committed me to reading it.
I think you will enjoy it. Seriously.
I probably will. I enjoyed this one. I really did. Yes. I didn't pick it up until, like I said, Tuesday. Today's Thursday.
But yes.
I read it in like one sitting. It was, it reads really fast.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm sorry it took us so long to get this done. But I'm glad to have done it, been on the other side. But it wasn't as scary as I thought it was going to be. Thank you, guys.
We're not terribly scared.
So appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, I was listening to one of our old podcasts, and we said in May we're going to have Sydney.
Academia.
Yes.
This is September, so missed the mark just that much.
Just that much. But I really do thank you for this opportunity.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thank you for being here.
Yes. You've given me two fun articles to read now.
Yes.
And really great insights.
Yes.
So are we going to wait another 4 months before the next one? Or?
No, we won't wait 4 months.
I'm hoping by end of September. Does that?
Hopefully so.
I know this is September, but we're going to consider this our August episode and try to get a September in because we got to get a horror in October.
That's our goal.
We don't know which one we're going to do yet, but we do know September's. Join us next episode. Mackenzie made me read this one because German, right?
Yep.
We'll be tearing down the walls with Daniela Crane's Irgendwann werden wir uns alles erzählen. Someday we'll tell each other everything. Emily Atef has a 2023 film adaptation of that. Very well done. So we're going back. Somebody told you, right? We needed a prestige film.
Yes.
So here we are, the falling of the Berlin Wall, May-December romance.
Per request. A lot of words I can't say.
There you go. Yeah, someday we'll tell each other everything. It is available on Kindle in an English translation, and I highly recommend reading the book. Speaking of reading it one day, I read this thing in 3 hours. I'm like, I'm not putting this down until I'm done. That's how good the book is. Film had to cut some stuff, but it's also very good. It is available either to rent on Amazon or if you subscribe to the Strand Releasing Channel, which I strongly suggest you do. It shows a lot of foreign films, particularly a lot of Asian films and a lot of European films, particularly Eastern European. Very good channel. I think it's $2.99 a month to subscribe to this thing, so it's well worth it. Either way, give it a watch, give it a read, and if you do have any thoughts, you can always get in touch with us.
Yep, remember to like, subscribe, leave a review, contact us. Our social media links are at Reel Lit Podcast. That's R-E-E-L, like a film reel. And email us at reellit@reellitpodcast.com. Also, shelf criticism plug for Steven on shelf criticism.
Oh, does that still exist? Speaking of time that has passed, it was February, wasn't it, when we did our talk at the library. And I was like, I'm going to do Arachnophobia after the talk. I got to take a couple weeks off. So yeah, it's September. I've got to get back and get that Arachnophobia episode. Plus, I got to do Anora. You just gave me my DVD back today.
Yeah, time is an abstract construct in academia. That's pretty much what I've got. And so for Shelf Criticism, you can contact Steven at steven@shelfcriticism.com. Remember, that is Steven, S-T-E-P-H-E-N.
That's right. P-H makes an F sound, like phonics.
Nice. Nice plug. And for Reel Lit, we're an Owls of Palace production. Our executive producer is Mordecai Miles. Our theme music is Honor and Sword by Zakhar Vahala. For Reel Lit, we're your hosts, Mackenzie and Steven. Until next time, may the odds be ever in your favor.
inconceivable.
I know.